This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to No Lies Radio.
Welcome to the special live edition of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, doing the show every Friday evening here at Revolution Radio on the web at freedomslips.com. And boy, freedom sure has been slipping away, hasn't it? But we're going to go out and get it back. That's right. We're not resting on our laurels here. The Truth Jihad has been going on since 2006 when I started doing this show on RBN. That's not Revolution Radio. That's the R4 Republic Broadcasting Network. So we've had 10 years almost of Truth Jihad Radio, and it's going strong. We've got Larry Silverstein on the run. If you've been catching my latest articles over at Veterans Today, you see that Larry Silverstein, the confessed demolisher of World Trade Center Building 7, is confessing. He can't keep his mouth shut. He can't stop from spilling the beans. But we're not going to talk about that in the first hour here. We're going to actually get going on a somewhat related topic, and that is the real reason why the elite does what it does. You know, they're not just playing games. They have reasons for what they do. And a lot of those reasons, if you really want to get to the bottom of them, you have to follow the money. And that's what my guest this hour, Ellen Brown, does. Ellen Brown is the author of Web of Debt, and she's following the money better than anybody, getting to the truth of how power works in today's corrupt world. So, hey, welcome, Ellen Brown.
Thanks, Kevin. Great talking to you.
Yeah, good to have you back. So we have an interesting election season, to say the least. These insurgent candidacies from Trump and Sanders, the specter of a Bush versus Clinton major party race, looks like that's we've been saved from that disaster. But we haven't necessarily been saved from Hillary Clinton. And your latest article on the amazing emails of Hillary Clinton revealing that they murdered Colonel Gaddafi in Libya and overthrew the government and basically destroyed that country, not to protect human rights, as they told us, but to protect the currency system. And you're the expert on that. So tell us about that.
Well, first I have to say I'm speaking on my own behalf and not on the behalf of any organization, which might happen to be a 501c3.
Me too.
Yeah, okay. We were told, as you say, that it was all about humanitarian concerns, that Gaddafi was a madman who was whose soldiers, military, were raping and pillaging and killing their own people. And so in her emails, it's confirmed that these were mere rumors from the rebels. So obviously not reliable. And humanitarian organizations had looked into it at the time and said there was no evidence for it. So nobody's ever found any evidence of, like, one of the most outrageous things is this idea that he was handing out Viagra to his troops.
Now, which PR agency do you think came up with that?
Yeah, well, apparently the evidence for it was that there was a package of Viagra found outside of a bombed tank. But the tank was bombed to smithereens, so it's kind of like that passport that fell out of the World Trade Center plane.
The only thing that survived was the Viagra tablet.
Now, that would be a great pharmaceutical ad.
I don't even want to see that. I'm tired of those stupid ads. You know, I watched some football this year during the Green Bay Packers season. And I suffered through those ads, including these pathetic ads for sexual aids. I mean, they didn't have that kind of stuff on TV when I was a kid. Anyway, getting back to Gaddafi.
Right. I was on TV. I don't watch TV anymore.
Well, yeah, I try not to. I have these friends and neighbors who are kind of into the Green Bay Packers and stuff like that. So I kind of hang out a little bit with my neighbors and watch sporting events and occasionally try to slip in a subversive word.
Yeah, I watch a lot of documentaries. There's some great documentaries on these days. I was thinking I should make a list of all the good ones because they tend to disappear after a while.
That's a really good idea. You know, we actually had that idea a while back here in Wisconsin. Rolf Lindgren, who's an interesting character, he was my campaign manager in 2008 when I was running against the banksters. He had this idea of doing a book of all of the best documentaries, just an encyclopedia, basically, of alternative documentaries. And you could have a pretty big encyclopedia of good alternative documentaries, couldn't you?
Yeah. I've seen good ones on North Korea, and, I mean, just places that you would never go yourself. and they give a real insight on what's going on. And, of course, it's never what the media tell us.
Right, right. Yeah, my old friend Andrei Volchek apparently touched down again. He's been to North Korea many times, and I think he just wrote something from there. I'm going to try and get him back on. But he says we've got it all wrong, that actually the North Koreans are heroic holdouts against the New World Order.
Yep, that's what these videos seem to indicate, too, and it looked credible to me.
And that's kind of what Gaddafi was, too.
Yeah. Well, so the other interesting email, the email that really piqued my interest and the reason I wrote about it was one from Sidney Blumenthal. A third of these emails, there were like 3,000 emails that were released on New Year's Eve of December 31 last year, and about a third of them were from Sidney Blumenthal, who was the Clinton confidant for 20 years, ever since he went after Monica Lewinsky, said she was stalking the president, and that was the first we ever heard of him, his first notoriety. So he wrote in this email that he gave the reasons why Sarkozy, the French president, had decided to back whatever you want to call it, the campaign against Libya, the military campaign, the bombing of Libya, was that his people had discovered that Gaddafi was organizing an African union that would use their own gold dinar and their own silver dirham, something like that. So he had something like 143 tons of gold, and he was issuing his own gold dinar through the Central Bank of Libya, which was a truly independent bank, not part of the Bank for International Settlement. And through this bank, he did amazing things. He funded this great irrigation system, the Great Man-Made River Project, which is the world's largest irrigation system. But anyway, that wasn't in the email. But what the email said was that he was organizing the African nations to all do this, use only the gold dinar. And apparently they'd met several times, and this was a real plan, and they were planning to have this in place by 2023. And already in Libya, you couldn't buy his oil or do any kind of course, the oil was nationalized, which is a bad, not a model they want spread to start with. But already you had to go through the Central Bank of Libya to do any kind of trade with Libya. So that was the interesting, really interesting email, that it confirmed something that I wrote about it in 2011, but a number of other people wrote about it too, which was very strange that a couple of weeks after the rebels, right at the very beginning of this alleged rebellion, the rebels set up their own central bank, like a central, which then became part of the Bank for International Settlement. You know, it's now supposedly the official central bank of Libya, but they set that up immediately. And who were these rebels? Supposedly guys in the desert who weren't satisfied with the government. So, but that was suspicious at the time, and people knew at the time that Gaddafi was planning to organize the African countries. I mean, in 2011, that was known. Well, in fact, that email was dated, I think, April 2011. Mm-hmm. So that was so now we've got published confirmation that the government knew all that, and this email said that was Sarkozy's motive, that he wanted to retain control over Africa. I didn't want Libya to replace France as the dominant power in the area. And they were, of course, concerned about this currency that would replace the French franc and the dollar and all the Western currencies that were currently being used for trade elsewhere.
You mentioned that these so-called Libyan rebels, who obviously were being trained by the CIA and who knows who else for decades, we know that Eastern Libya was a hotbed of CIA activity and the rest of the Western intelligence agencies, the Israeli Mossad, they're all playing around over there trying to stir up trouble for Gaddafi. And then these guys who were told, they just come out of nowhere, they're just protesters, they miraculously create a central bank linked to the BIS, Bank for International Settlements, like a couple of weeks into their rebellion. And yet, of course, these guys can't even come close to governing Libya today. It's all a feuding tribe of Mad Max-style warlords running around there now. It's really pretty obvious that this was a sort of a coup d'etat regime change operation. But what really makes me annoyed about this, Ellen, is that the opposition to Gaddafi portrayed itself as holier than thou, Islamically speaking. They pretended to be an Islamic opposition, and they didn't like the way Gaddafi was supposedly heretical. His brand of Islam was not pure enough for them. They're all, you know, Salafi, Saudi-funded types, you know, taking money from the Saudis who were in bed with the big banksters. And so they claim that they're doing this for religious reasons to overthrow Gaddafi, but wait a minute. I mean, it's the worst possible sin in Islam, pretty much, besides shirk, which is association with God, and, you know, idolatry, is interest, is riba. Any kind of interest is, like, there are these sacred sayings from Quran and Hadith making it clear that taking a penny of interest on a loan is the equivalent of doing things that I can't even talk about on the radio. It's horrible. It's completely taboo, completely haram or forbidden. And so what Gaddafi was doing by getting out of the interest-based or reba-based, usury-based Western Rothschild petrodollar coming out of BIS and all of the world's big controlled central banks run by the banksters was an absolutely Islamically correct thing. In fact, he's probably just about the only real Muslim in the position of power on the planet when he's doing that. And then the supposedly Islamic rebels who are actually working for the Shaitan, they're on the army of Satan, but pretending to be more Muslim than Gaddafi, overthrow him to install a Rothschild central bank.
Exactly.
Make stuff up. I mean, as a Muslim, I am ready to wage jihad when I hear this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, and that's the beauty of having your own central bank. You could fund things interest-free, which is what they did with that great man-made river. I think, you know, Gaddafi, that was a 40-year project. It was you see pictures of it in these gigantic tubes, whatever you call them, cylinders made out of some sort of durable plastic or something that were huge, like several people could stand in them. And there were several of these wide, so the water was just gushing out of the desert, from underneath the desert. They found enough water underneath the desert, supposedly, to keep all of Libya in water for 50 years. Well, what's that water doing under the desert? That, I think it was primary water. That's another one of these scarcity myths, that there's not enough water. The only water that exists is the water that's been in the air and then it falls down on the ground. That's not true. The Japanese researchers have discovered that there is five times as much water under the Earth's mantle, like 5 miles down, than above it. There are all these oceans of water underneath.
Really?
And, of course, you can't drill for 5 miles, but whenever you have volcanoes or earthquakes, this stuff pushes up from the bottom up into these fissures. So all you have to do is find the fissures, and there are now new ways of doing that. So Gaddafi himself said in 1992, when they managed to get the water to the cities, it was an ongoing project because they're still bringing water to the desert to turn it into agricultural land. But when they got it into the cities, he said, he kind of laughed, and he said he was probably going to be killed for this. And he said that they would be redoubling their efforts to get him after he'd done this. And he was planning to bring this whole plan to all of Africa, show them how they could fund their own development. They didn't need the West. They could have their own money. Clearly, they're very resource rich. All they have to do is kick out the Westerners who own everything and take back their oil, take back their gold and their resources. And the one thing they might have thought they were short of is water, but the water is there, and he would have shown them. I mean, if what we're talking about is ordinary aquifer water, the water wouldn't have been there. So how did he figure he was going to take water to all of Africa? But he's going to show them how to do what he had done, become self-sufficient. So.
Wow, that's really interesting. You know, just as an aside, you're not playing with a rubber duck, are you? Because there's this weird squeaking.
I'm sorry. It's my chair.
Your chair. You need to oil your chair, Ellen.
I should use this fake back chair. You're right.
I see. Okay. Well, as long as you're not in the bathtub, playing with a rubber duck.
I'm sorry. I'll try to sit still.
All right. The official story of the water underneath North Africa, which I learned, because I'm a North Africa specialist, supposedly. I did a Fulbright in Morocco and got my PhD mainly studying aspects of Moroccan Islam. And the official story is that the climate has changed, and what's now desert, the Sahara of North Africa, it used to be lush and green and full of rain and full of forests and jungles and swamps and lakes, lots and lots and lots of lakes. And it's explained that this wasn't that long ago, like 5,000 years ago, just as the Old Kingdom was rising in Egypt. That was towards the end of this period when there was tons and tons of water across what's now the Sahara. And there are, of course, famous cave paintings of the swimmers of the cave in the middle of the Sahara Desert, where there's virtually no rain and there hasn't been for a couple thousand years at least. There are these cave paintings showing people swimming around and showing with hippopotamuses and I forget what all the water animals were. So according to the official story, that aquifer water is aquifer water because there used to be lots and lots and lots of water there. The surface is all dried up. But of course, it did go down under the ground and get trapped in the bedrock and stuff. And so there's lots of water there because it didn't used to be a desert. So that's the official story. But your version sounds really interesting, and I will have to look into that.
Okay, go to primarywaterinstitute.org. They've got awesome for research.
Primary Water Institute. Cool. Okay. Yeah, well, I think Gaddafi was right that they're, when he said they're going to come after me for this kind of stuff, because that's what they do. There's this brand new version of the John Perkins book. It's called The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. His original Confessions of an Economic Hitman was a bestseller when that came out, not that long after 9/11. And he came on my radio show and explained that the reason he wrote that book was he visited Ground Zero shortly after it happened, and he took a look at it, and he knew, based on the people he'd been working with, that this wasn't done by guys in caves with box cutters or anything like that. And he's kind of, in the book, he's a little bit, he kind of tiptoes around it a little bit. I mean, you have to read a little bit between the lines, but he does tell you it. He tells you this, that basically 9/11 truth is the motivation for Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which was a New York Times bestseller. And now it's out again with a lot of new material. But anyway, he talked about how his job was to go and basically run a kind of a racket, shaking down heads of state, offering them a fistful of $100 bills in return for taking usurious unpayable loans from the World Bank. And the purpose of this was to get these countries deep into debt they could never pay back, so then the banksters could lean on them, as it were, L-I-E-N, or however you want to spell lean on them, and grab up all their resources. So this is kind of how it works. And then if the leader of the country wouldn't go along with Perkins or the other economic hitmen, in would come the jackals or the asteroids, whatever you want to call them, the professional killers who specialize in taking down leaders of countries or U.S. senators like Wellstone or whoever in plane crashes. And they'll also sometimes apparently give people cancer, as happened to Hugo Chavez. And so these people, and if that doesn't work, if they can't get to them with the asteroids, then they send in the military one way or another, which they had to do to Saddam Hussein, and it's what they had to do to Noriega in Panama, and that's pretty much what they had to do to Gaddafi as well. So that's really how the world is run. It's obvious that Perkins was right, even though the establishment doesn't want us to admit that. And it's really disgusting. I mean, these are the people that rule the world, these racketeers, these criminals.
You assume they're people.
Wait a minute. You're already going down the rabbit hole or the what do you call it, the water hole, the water crevasse of water conspiracy theory. Don't tell me that you buy into David Icke's contention that we're being ruled by alien extraterrestrial lizards.
Well,
I listen
to his stuff. It's pretty interesting. I also listened to Catherine Austin Fitz, who became convinced after, she was assistant secretary of HUD under George Bush Sr. And she lost her. She was investigating all this money that disappeared, the black budget money they're very innocently, you know, just trying to keep the budget. And she developed a program to figure out where it went. And all of a sudden she lost her job and everybody was after her and she was afraid for her life. So she wound up, you know, really looking into it. But she said when she worked with those people, whoever they are, the military people, she said they weren't human. I mean, they were cold, like they didn't have empathy. There was something different about them. Mm-hmm. So she and then the more she got into it, I mean, after she had all these terrible traumas, she decided they were ETs and they weren't from here. But then, of course, there's a whole school of that we're all ETs. That
well, then how can we all have feelings?
Well, I mean, we are all genetically manipulated going back thousands of years, and that's why we don't really belong here. I mean, the animals can sleep on the ground and eat stuff right off the trees, and they don't have to wear sunglasses or sunscreen, or, you know, we're not really adapted to this place all that well.
Yeah.
So the argument is that we were genetically manipulated, and that goes back to the Sumerian cuneiform writings, which say that there were two gods. There was one that was trying to exploit us, just wanted a worker race to do the work. They mine the gold and do the agricultural stuff, tend the garden. And then the other was the one that actually genetically manipulated us along with his consort, Inanna. And he saw us as our children, as his children, and was the loving God. So you've got two forces in the universe, that the one force that's exploitative and, well, it'd be like the Matrix. I mean, it all makes a good, it's interesting, an interesting possibility. Like the Matrix, that there's a fourth dimensional level where there are entities pulling the strings. I mean, it just seems to me that so many amazing things are going on. It is hard to imagine how human beings could pull off some of these things. Like my ex-husband worked for USAID, and when I posed these theories about 9/11, he said, no, he said the government couldn't pull that off. He said, I worked for the government. They're just not that organized. So it's somebody more organized than your ordinary politicians or even your ordinary military.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. You know, and I'm not discounting the likelihood that there must be all sorts of advanced intelligences swarming around in the universe and presumably coming through here, because, you know, we might very well have a lot of cool resources, or would be interesting conceivably to some of these, you know, to some percentage, even a small percentage of the zillions of likely intelligences throughout the universe. I mean, that'll make sense. And also, I'm convinced that there is, an alam al-akhirah, as we call it in Islam, another world, a world that we're not seeing with our senses most of the time, and that all sorts of information travels in these ways that modern materialistic science does not understand, but the ancients and most other cultures have understood. I mean, everybody has psi experiences, and in virtually every culture, that's just taken for granted. But somehow we've been brainwashed to think that this is all superstition in this culture. So yeah, the world is much, much bigger, of course, than our, you know, our cultural programming would tell us. On the other hand, just because it wasn't the government as the government that did 9/11 doesn't mean that there couldn't be human beings, maybe not worthy of the name, but still basically human beings genetically.
Well, they could have been here for thousands of years just like we have, but they may not be. It may be a different, I don't know.
Maybe. Well, you know, Catherine Austin Fitz talks about the lack of empathy of these high-level military guys and stuff. That, I think, can be partly induced. Well, for one thing, we do have this study of psychopathy that shows that 2% of the male population in the U.S. and, you know, slightly lower populations most other places, or lower percentages, that is totally non-empathetic, and, you know, has these traits of sort of ruthlessly selfish, almost mechanical selfishness, able to just lie like they breathe, able to kill humans the way most of us could swat mosquitoes. That such mm-hmm. people do exist. 2%. So, like, you know, if you know 100 people around you.
How do you know that's not a line of ETs?
Well, that's conceivable. They're pretty weird damn ETs, if that's the case. I don't know, though. I also
just speculating.
Think,
I'm not...
Yeah.
It's interesting.
There could be some crossover there, certainly. But also, I think you can get sort of manufactured psychopathy in relatively normal humans. I mean, that's what basic training does in the military. That's what they engineered it to do.
Or you can give them drugs to do that, for sure.
Drugs, yeah. Or initiation rituals for various kinds of gangs, like the drug gang in, was it Georgia or someplace like that? I think it was a military-linked drug gang where to be inducted into the gang, you had to go kill somebody. And then they would have evidence that you did that, and then they would, you know, hold that over your head, and now you're one of them. And probably the people that do this kind of become psychopathic just based on what they've done. Likewise with the people at Skull and Bones, like Bush and John Kerry. They both lay naked in coffins in front of all of these other people in the crypt at Yale University and masturbated while recounting their entire sexual history to this assembled crowd around them, which supposedly includes some of their fathers. I mean, this is bizarre. The people that do this, and then they're trained to believe that they're the elite, they should only care about their bonesman brothers, and everybody else is just sheeple to be manipulated or used. And you know, I think they manufacture psychopaths through these kinds of rituals. So I think normal humans can become psychopathic, whether or not we have any alien DNA. And I would think that maybe if we have some alien DNA, it wouldn't all be making us psychopaths. Maybe some of it would actually be making us better, more special. Maybe, you know, maybe the great people like Jesus, Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, people like that actually are more alien than the average person. They're certainly, you know, better than your average human.
Yeah, well, and I would agree. I mean, there's this whole other universe that we haven't explored. The fact of consciousness isn't really admitted by science. I mean, you can't find it. What is it? It's not really studied. What happens? Where do you go when you die? It's not really studied. It's all considered myth. But you must go somewhere. Either you do or you don't. At least half the global population thinks that you survived death. So,
well, and they're probably right. The empirical evidence, which is mostly kind of anecdotal, but it's good anecdotal evidence, suggests that, yes, there is this evidence for the survival of consciousness after death, at least in the sense that there are many, many, many cases of little children who have these memories of people who lived and died before them that have been quite fully confirmed. Interestingly enough, the place I first saw this evidence was in an article by none other than David Ray Griffin, the greatest scholar in the 9/11 truth movement. He, one of the reasons that when I heard that he was saying that 9/11 was an inside job, that really woke me up and made me look into it, was I'd studied David's work before. I used some of his work in my dissertation. And one of the things he had done was a study of the evidence for the survival of consciousness after death. And he had concluded that it was very, very strong. And that was the first place I ran into. This was back long before 9/11 or any of that. This is the, you know, kind of place where I first was encountering Griffin. Yeah, so yeah, there is that evidence.
I used to study that stuff too. Before I went to law school, when I figured out I couldn't support myself as a writer, I studied all these things I wanted to write about in my 20s. And that was one of them. But I bet I know the book. It's 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation by Ian Stevenson of Duke University, right?
I think that was one he was referring to, yeah. Yeah. And of course, there's all kinds of other evidence for psi. And my favorite work along those lines, at least, you know, the popular work, is by Dean Radin, who I had on the show, when was that, like 2 or 3 years ago. And he's with the Noetic Sciences Institute. He used to teach at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And one of the things that he was involved in there was that all the casinos in Las Vegas hire psi people. They hire telepaths and clairvoyants to stop the psi cheaters. They have to pay money to make sure that psi cheaters don't come into their establishments and rob them blind. So, you know, and there are lots of other actual applied psi things going on all over the place, including in the military, where The Men Who Stare at Goats by John Ronson was apparently written and turned into a movie, partly to sort of make light of this area and to hold up the parts of the military psi research that didn't really work or that can be ridiculed in order to direct attention away from the ones that are working all too well.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of those people are obviously pretty psychopathic if they're not alien reptiles. It's, you know, they're doing terrible things. And, you know, they're torturing people at Guantanamo as part of mind control experiments, as Ronson finds. And John Ronson, he's this Jewish, middle-class, very establishment kind of guy from London, you know, and his job is to kind of explore these crazy conspiracy theories and kind of make light of them and have some fun with them, write humorous books. But even John Ronson has to admit that, yeah, they were doing these horrific mind control experiments at Guantanamo. They were blasting people with, like, I forget, heavy metal music, or there's some other really bizarre choices of music they were hitting these guys with and just blasting them for 24/7 for God knows how long. And who knows what they were putting under the music. But there were all kinds of these torture-based, trauma-based mind control things going on post 9/11, just like back in the 50s. When they murdered, I think more than 100 people were actually tortured to death in the CIA mind control experiments in Project Artichoke. So the people that do that kind of stuff, and, you know, some of them, like, what was his name, Olson, who was murdered for being unreliable and possibly spilling the beans about this torturing, you know, huge numbers of people to death in CIA mind control experiments. People that do this stuff, I don't know if they're alien reptiles, but they definitely have some kind of empathy deficit.
Empathy deficit. Well, speaking of religion, can I ask you?
Sure.
Since you're an expert, you hear different people like, well, now that we have this whole Trump issue about racism and stuff, and you see people quoting the Quran saying basically kill all the infidels and that sort of thing, you know, outrageous things. And I'm sure that's not what it really says, but I wondered what your take is on all that.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing. If you've been through any religious studies and done any work on Islam, that this anti-Islam propaganda campaign is all, I shouldn't say all, but it's primarily driven by people who identify as Jews. Let's be honest about this. And essentially, these people who identify as Jews are trying to convince people from Christian backgrounds that Islam is evil and crazy and we need to have this huge war on Islam. Oh, and just incidentally, that'll help protect the future of the occupied state in Palestine. So let's compare the Quran and the Jewish Torah, okay? Now, anybody who sits down and actually reads those two books, and of course, to really read them, and especially the Quran, you need a little bit of Arabic, or you need to look at a few different translations and listen to how people are, you know, explaining them. But there's no comparison. The Quran is totally milquetoast. It's Mother Teresa compared to the Torah or the Old Testament. The Old Testament is full of insane genocidal passages. Thinking, mm-hmm. Kill them all, kill the men, kill the women, kill the children, you know, burn all their crops, kill all their animals, burn the whole thing to the ground, yada, 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 on and on and on and on and on. There's tons of insane genocidal stuff in the Old Testament, plus all kinds of other insane stuff, like, you know, Abraham supposedly is going to turn his wife into a whore to try to manipulate the Pharaoh. And, you know, I don't even want to get into it. It's anybody who takes the Torah as a holy book is completely out of their mind. It's great literature. It's really good literature. It's wonderful to discuss it and try and derive some interesting morality and philosophy out of that. But it is an utterly insane book. Anybody who took that as scripture, the word of God telling you how to behave, has got to be a lunatic. And
yeah.
Yet the people who come out of that tradition are trying to tell us that the Quran, which is totally sensible, if you read it properly in context, it is utterly 100% sensible. It's, mm-hmm. And they're trying to make the Quran out to be the crazy book. These people, it's their chutzpah is beyond description.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought about that with these false flags that they're accusing Gaddafi of doing. I mean, who would have even thought of that, putting fake dead bodies around to make it look like the Americans were bombing? That was supposedly our defense to their evidence that we are bombing. But that's the type of thing that we would, that our, you know, whoever it is,
Yeah, yeah. Shameless liars. Yeah, shameless liars. And of course, it's not just people from Jewish backgrounds who are the shameless liars. Let's face it, it's become kind of American policy too, especially in these in the Middle East and these other, you know, third world type regions where we've slaughtered about 55 million people since World War II in U.S. CIA and military interventions. But getting back to the religion thing, the stuff about slay the infidels in the Quran. Number one, that's a very, very small part of the Quran that is being yanked out of context. And number two, you go back and you look at these particular passages that are supposedly being quoted, and they are all clearly revealed passages about particular situations. And the basic situation here is that they're at war. The Muslim community is trying to fight for its life. The Prophet Muhammad was almost killed. They tried to kill him. They had brutally persecuted his followers. And to save his life, he snuck out of town and barely escaped with his life. So they set up this alternative community out in Medina. And Mecca was clearly going to crush Medina. And Mecca is run by these so-called pagans or polytheists, the mushrikun, et cetera, the kuffar, these words for infidel or whatever, that describes these people that the first Muslim community in Medina was at war with. And so the word in Arabic, qatala is the root, it can mean either to kill or to do battle with. So basically what these passages are about is, you know, we're at war and we have to do battle with this enemy. And that's all it is. It has nothing to do with running around so supposedly killing unbelievers. That's totally the product of ripping it out of context in order to distort it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one reason that, for example, that Donald Trump thinks that Muslims hate Americans or some Muslims or many Muslims is that if you actually believed that the World Trade Center was brought down by Muslims in airplanes, then you would think these guys are really dangerous and they really hate us. They're out to get us for some reason. It seems to me that that's probably the whole goal, to split people up, to make people suspicious of their neighbors, so you don't get together with your neighbors and overthrow the existing government, or I shouldn't say overthrow, but you know what I mean, change the existing government, that we're all afraid, we're supposed to be afraid, very afraid, afraid of who might be living next door to you that might be some religion that is theological or whatever, doctrinally out to get you. And the evidence is these horrible things that supposedly Muslims did that we question whether Muslims really did them.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that divide and conquer thing, that politics of fear thing, I mean, this is very much part of it. And when you ask yourself, well, why do they specifically target Islam? The politically correct answer in the truth movement is, oh, they just needed a new enemy after the Cold War. So this is insisting that it was basically a U.S. imperial thing, that we needed a new enemy to justify military budgets. And yeah, I think that's partly true. But I think there's another element, too, which is that, you know, why would they want to necessarily go after Muslims? Why not make somebody else the enemy? Why not do Buddhists? You know, why not do Chinese or Russians or black people, Africans, whatever? I mean, you know, imagine that Trump was saying that, no, we can't let any more black people come into the country. You know, that would hardly be even tolerated by anybody, but he could say it about Muslims. But it could just as easily have been black people. It could just as easily have been any group on earth could have been set up and scapegoated in a false flag like 9/11 to make people hate them. But why did they choose Muslims specifically? I think there are a number of reasons. The biggest reason is that the U.S. and the West have absolutely no problem, nothing to fear whatsoever from Islam or Muslims, geostrategically or in any other way. Yeah, maybe you have to fear a little bit, you know, of demographic increase among Muslims, but why fear it? Who cares? You know, who cares if the Episcopalians are going to be a little more numerous? Who cares if the Muslims are going to be a little more numerous? It doesn't matter. But who has something to fear? It's the Israelis. Israel is squatting on stolen land, and they're committing genocide every day against the Palestinians. And the Muslim world doesn't like it because Palestine has been Muslim Muslim-administered Holy Land ever since Islam existed, basically. So Israel has a huge problem with Islam and with Muslims. And they had to sell that to the whole West and say, you guys all have the same problem, too. And that's what those Israeli spies arrested for setting up in advance and then filming and celebrating the destruction of the towers told the police who arrested them. They said, the Palestinians are not just our problem, they're your problem, they're everybody's problem. And of course, that was the message of, that was the number one message of 9/11. It's really about dragging the entire West into an eternal or at least 100-year war on behalf of Israel against the Islamic world. That's the biggest reason. And part of the reason they had to do that, Ellen, was that Muslim demographic increase in the Western countries is posing a, or was then, posing a political threat to the Zionists and the central banksters. Because in Islam, there's a very, very strong movement against lending at interest, against usury. So Islam and Muslims are natural enemies of the central banksters and this currency system. And then number two, Muslims were starting to learn how to exercise their democratic rights. And if that had continued the way it was happening in 2000, today there would be no Israel. It would have already been gone, because it was actually Muslims who elected George W. Bush in 2000. Sami Alarian organized the Muslim community in the United States, delivered the Muslim vote to the Bush-Cheney ticket, stupidly as it turned out. But Bush-Cheney promised to stop kidnapping and torturing and disappearing Muslims, and the Democrats didn't. So, boom, they normally 90% of Muslims in the U.S. were voting Democratic. Sami Alarian organized the Muslim community in the U.S. and especially in Florida, delivered the election in especially Florida to Bush-Cheney. And that was just the beginning. And if there hadn't been 9/11, that process would have reached the point that Muslim empowerment in the U.S. and in Europe today would have led to the voting down of any kind of support for Israel, and Israel would have folded by now. So this is why they did 9/11. The way things were going in 2000 with the demographic issue in Palestine, the intifadas, and the growth of Muslim power in the democratic electoral system in the West was going to be putting Israel out of business within a decade. That's the main reason they did 9/11.
I recently saw a video. It was Larry Silverstein in the summer of 2011. Or was it 20? I mean, sorry. Was it 2001 or the summer of 2000? I forget. But anyway, before 9/11, and he had contracted to lease the World Trade Center. And he said about Building 7 that it was going to have to be rebuilt or redone, and they were going to chop three floors off the top. They were going to make it three floors shorter, and they had already done the design. So there's only, how are you going to chop some floors off? You're going to have to demolish the thing. So it was the suspicious building that went down for no reason. He admitted on tape that they had decided to pull it, which meant to do a demolition on it right then at, you know, during 9/11. So it was definitely a plan.
Yeah, you know, I just wrote that story up for Veterans Today yesterday.
Oh, really?
And yeah, posted the video where this video was actually from a talk he gave like a year or two ago. And in that talk, he admitted that they had planned, they designed the new Building 7.
Probably quoting you, sorry.
You probably are.
I was impressed. It was compelling.
They designed the new Building 7 in April of 2000. So that was about a year and a half before 9/11. They already designed the new Building 7. And yet, as Richard Gage pointed out in his appearance on False Flag Weekly News today, the timeline doesn't make any sense unless indeed that was true. And to do that, though, that meant that, like, how could they do a new Building 7 with no way of taking down the old one? Because there was no way. You can't just do a controlled demolition in the middle of New York City. There's no way you're ever going to get a permit for that. And so you take it down piece by piece, and it's going to cost you hundreds of times what it's worth. So it just makes no sense that out of the blue in April of 2000, Silverstein and his people are going to design a new Building 7 without any conceivable way of getting rid of the old Building 7. I mean, at that time, Ellen, the tallest building that had ever been demolished in a controlled demolition was about 30 stories. Building 7 was 47 stories. And of course, the Twin Towers, which they were also desperate to demolish because they were condemned for asbestos. They had antiquated communications equipment. And John Perkins talks about this in Confessions of Economic Hitman. these, there was no way they were going to get these demolitions, and yet they had to, because the city was ordered to get rid of all the asbestos from the Twin Towers. And that would have cost billions, probably double-digit billions, again, way more than these useless old white elephant buildings were worth. So Larry Silverstein then goes and buys the whole World Trade Center complex. He already owned seven, but he goes and buys the rest of the World Trade Center complex and finishes buying it on a 100-year lease in July of 2001, 2 months before 9/11. He hardballs his insurers to double the terror insurance and change the terms to cash payout. And then he hits the jackpot on 9/11, the only day in all of history, pretty much, that he wasn't on top of Windows of the World, because he supposedly remembered an appointment with his dermatologist. So everybody there died, but he survived, goes to court, demands double indemnity on his already doubled insurance policy. He said, on what basis? He says there were two completely separate and unrelated terror attacks. The two airplanes! So, and on and on. And so he goes later, he grabs over $5 billion of insurance money on his measly $15 million investment, another $100 million of his backers. Now he's floating in money, and he's been doing more and more scams ever since as he rebuilds these towers. He was back in court looking for another $10 billion, and that got shot down. Larry Silverstein is the living embodiment of chutzpah. He also happens to be a close friend of Benjamin Netanyahu. He's on the phone every weekend with Netanyahu, according to Haaretz newspaper in Israel. So it's like, it's so obvious what's going on here, Ellen. It's mind-boggling that this information has been withheld from the American people.
Mm-hmm. And yet they know they can get away with it, because if it's not in the major media, then it's not true. They get to determine what truth is, and the rest of us are just talking around the internet.
But I think it's getting more and more into a sort of an internet journalism era. And that's why Trump has been so successful, I think. You know, the mainstream media has tried to shoot down the Trump campaign, and Trump has managed to keep a lot of support by saying all these things that make the mainstream media bash him. But nobody trusts the mainstream media anymore. So the more it bashes him, the more popular he gets. I mean, is this the dynamic, or am I missing something?
Yeah, no, and I think that people are ready to see things stirred up. They want somebody who's going to go in there, barrel in, and be tough. And he doesn't seem to be afraid of anything. And what I think is promising is that he might actually do monetary reform. Certainly the old school politicians won't, namely the Clinton faction, but he might.
He called for auditing the Fed.
Sorry?
He supports auditing the Fed. He supported Rand Paul's bill to audit the Fed.
He thinks we can do it all. We can have it all. I mean, he's got these grand visions, and there's really only one way we can have it all, and that's to print our own money and get rid of that debt. We can just print our way out of debt, and it will not be inflationary, my contention is, and I'm writing about that now.
Wow, I'm looking forward to that article. Well, your new book is The Public Banking Solution. That's the most recent one, right?
Yeah,
The Public Banking Solution.
It's actually a book, and it's called Infrastructure Without Debt.
Right. And yeah, this is a really important book, because so often people ask, well, what are the solutions? Okay, we see all of these problems. And you know, the problems do all tie in to this usurious currency system, which is all about debt slavery. And so you could really, if not solve, at least, you know, really improve the situation on a whole huge cross-section of these issues just by doing monetary reform, just getting this power out of the hands of the central banksters and having a public and transparent currency system. And so that, yeah, I think you're really, you know, zoning in here, zooming in on the solution that's most likely to work. Can you imagine, though, that these masters of the universe, the people who used to employ John Perkins and the asteroids, you know, that are used to being able to just blow up the Twin Towers with 3,000 people inside and blame it on their enemies and get away with murder in a million ways, are these people really going to let someone like Trump not only win but then enact that kind of program?
Well, that's a good question. He's brave.
Yeah. You know,
he may be brave because he doesn't, well, he must know what he's getting into. But I mean, if he actually thinks 9/11 was done by Muslims, maybe he doesn't realize what a danger being president, you know, how hazardous that could be to your health.
Yeah, boy, I don't know. I mean, I have to wonder what, you know, the theories range from some people think that Trump is really just kind of a puppet playing a role that's been assigned to him. And some folks think that that would be to get Hillary elected. Like, you know, according to this theory, he's going to self-destruct and pretty much there's no choice but Hillary. I don't know, though. I would like to think that, you know, he's really channeling this populist energy, and there's more and more.
I think that's true. He seems sincere to me, misguided in many ways, but sincere.
Yeah. In some ways, he's sort of out neocon the neocons. He's hoisted them on their own petard. You know, they're the ones who set this Islamophobia up with 9/11. You know, they intentionally created this wave of Islamophobia to serve their interests, and primarily Israel's interests, in my opinion, but also, of course, their personal career interests, everybody who invested in this terror industrial complex and all of that. But now they're quaking in their boots because Trump is breaking with enslavement to Israel, although he's going to AIPAC. I don't know what he's been saying, if it was tonight or recently. You know, he's going to have a meeting at AIPAC or do a talk at AIPAC. We'll see how that goes, but he has.
Well, that's probably he's covering his bet.
Yeah, he must be. Yeah, he said, I can't
make any enemies there.
Yeah, he says I can't do the presidential debate because I have to go talk to some really important people, people who run the country. AIPAC.
Yeah, the guys with the money.
Yeah.
More money than he's got.
Right.
Well, and he's also sort of beaten him at their own game by he's got his own money and he got it through capitalism that very system that, and he just admits, you know, that these are not nice people, and he's quite aware of that's how the game is played, and he's playing it. Like, we might as well, let's beat them at their own game.
Yeah, I think he's doing a great job as a politician, as much as I have to say that it's pretty disgusting. We've had this, you know, anti-Muslim genocide since 9/11, and you know, buying that official story, which he supposedly doesn't. I mean, we've heard from, was it Roger Stone, one of his top advisors, that he knows that there's something hinky about 9/11. So if so, you know, why would he be ranting about how Muslims hate us and we have to keep Muslims out of the country and we might have to make them wear yellow moons or whatever? Well, maybe that's all a political game or just channeling the populist zeitgeist. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, but then looking on the flip side, if what he said was we have to, they're really upset about something. We have to look into that and find out what really happened. So if he really looked into what really happened, we might get something like an investigation, like the PCORA investigation in the 30s or whenever it was, investigating the Federal Reserve.
Well, this would be such forces rising up against any kind of real investigation of 9/11, I would really wonder how that could possibly play out. And, you know, ideally, somehow it would turn into a real investigation, get at the truth, and, you know, lance this boil and heal the country. But I could also see that the forces arrayed against it would see, oh, well, Trump, he's ridden into the White House on all this, you know, populist Islamophobia. So let's just do another 9/11 type thing, and he's not going to have a whole lot of choice because we're going to really make it look like it was done by Muslims. We're going to set up the patsies a lot better this time than we did that time.
Well, I don't know. They keep all these false flags, you know, immediately. It used to be it took a couple of days anyway before people figured out there was something fishy about it. But now immediately, the day it happened, somebody's got a video up with pointing out all kinds of suspicious things.
Yeah, well, and that's
people are very suspicious these days. They're not going to be.
Yeah, that's the whole theme of my new book, Another French False Flag: Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. That book is not just about the Paris and San Bernardino false flags, but also about this new phenomenon of people just jumping on them right away and exposing them, and, you know, arguing that we should essentially assume these things are false flags until proven otherwise. If it walks like a false flag, if it quacks like a false flag, it's probably a false flag. And the more people think that way, and they, you know, my article after Paris went viral, hit 100,000 reads in a day or two. My article after San Bernardino hit 300,000 reads within a day or two. Obviously, there's a huge audience out there that is interested in learning about these things as false flags. And I think that's putting us in a different world. And if we continue on this path, pretty soon, they're not going to be able to do any false flags because they just won't work anymore.
Yeah, hopefully.
So I hope that we reach that point before, you know, Trump gets into the White House and the neocons say, oh, boy, you know, we don't want to be swinging from a rope. So we better, you know, do a big one and, you know, blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago or wherever. And I mean, that's the natural thing for them to do, to try to stop Trump or try to head off any kind of serious thrust after their own power. And, you know, if it's going after the power of the banksters as well as the neocons, you know, that's a recipe for some real interesting havoc.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we'll see how that plays out. So we only have about a minute left before the bumper music starts. Ellen, tell us about your website and your books.
Well, my website is ellenbrown.com, and my two books on this subject are Public Bank Solution and Web of Debt, and they're available on Amazon. And my website has hundreds of articles on the subject.
All right. Well, this recent article on Hillary's emails exposing that the real reason for taking out Gaddafi was not human rights, but it was to keep the bankster monopoly on currency in general and the French monopoly over North Africa in particular. I imagine the U.S. Interests in Africa as well were affected. I mean, this is a really good, a very, very important article. You said your next article is about Trump?
No. Oh, no. I'm writing a book on infrastructure without debt.
Ah, okay.
Now, I have to avoid, Hillary's emails was just, I was just presenting the facts there, but I'm not allowed to get into politics.
Okay, so you're not going to tell us who you're going to vote for.
Jill Stein.
Jill Stein, okay. Yeah, I can kind of see, well, you know, we're going to have
Well, no, I'd vote for Bernie, but I guess I'm not supposed to say that, but anyway.
Yeah, I think Bernie is at the top of my list, too.
It's a question whether he'll get the nomination. That's the problem.
But, you know, we have an alternative, Ellen. In the second hour of the show, Ed Baker is coming on, and he is a presidential candidate from Arizona, and we're going to hear what he has to say. So we'll see if he's on board with these issues. Thank you so much. Ellen Brown, it's always great talking with people.
Thank you, Kevin.
Take care.
Great talking to you.
Okay, welcome back to Truth Jihad Radio. Sorry, we're having a little technical issue here. I'm on the phone with Ed Baker, trying to find a way to get him hooked up here to our call. But we're having a little technical issue because for whatever reason. Oh, there we go. Okay, we're going to get him. I'm just trying to get Ed all connected in here to the network. So I think we can add him to the call. And we'll bring it in. Okay, Ed Baker is running for president, and there are lots of reasons to vote for him. He's not Hillary Clinton. He's not even Donald Trump. He's certainly not Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, any of those crazy guys. But he's his own man, and let's hear about it. Welcome, Ed Baker. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing tonight, Kevin?
Doing very well. Well, hey, so I was just talking with Ellen Brown of Web of Debt, and that was her first book. She's the leading expert on public banking and why we need to end the Fed and the bankster monopoly on currency, have a public and transparent currency system. And she said of all of the major candidates, the only one that she even can stand at all is Bernie Sanders, although certain things about Trump are interesting. Why should she vote for you?
Well, I'm not a member of any political party. I'm somebody that, you know, I don't believe in labeling people with things like liberal, conservative, right wing, left wing. I try to look at each issue individually, try to learn everything I can about it, and then give my thoughts. I'm always open to hearing other points of view about issues and trying to learn everything that I can. As I learn more facts, I'm always open to, you know, looking at the you know, what's best again and reevaluating my position, but I'll never compromise my values in doing that. I'm not a career politician. I think I'm a lot more in touch with the everyday American than the other names that are going to be on the ballot. And I look at those other candidates that have a D or an R next to their name, and when I hear them speak, it sounds to me like they're saying, I'm going to represent this group of Americans and not this other group. In my case, nobody's going to agree with me on everything, but if you disagree with me on one important issue, it doesn't mean the next four or five important issues to you, you might agree with me on.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about this political system is that, you know, rather than voting issue by issue, we have to vote for candidates. And each candidate is going to have a position on every one of the however many issues we care about. And probably we, you know, all of us would have, you know, a position on at least, you know, 40 or 50 issues and, you know, maybe into the hundreds. And so if you try to diagram this mathematically, trying to find a perfect fit for a candidate is going to be pretty hard most of the time. So what we end up doing is allowing our brains to be channeled into these pre-existing cookie cutter paradigms. Okay, I'm a left Democrat, so I must vote for Bernie, or, you know, or I, you know, I'm a mainstream Democrat, I must vote for Hillary, or I'm a conservative Republican, you know, I must vote for so-and-so. And, you know, we kind of, I think, lose our ability to break down the issues and figure out what's really going on in the world and how we could really affect it. So I don't know. Have you thought of the possibility of doing some kind of direct democracy where people could just vote on issues?
I mean, I just look at each. How do I want to say this? You know, I play within the rules that are in place, so to speak. You know, some people say to me, "Well, I'm not voting for anybody. I believe we need a total revolution. Need to, you know, all this stuff." And I say, "Good for you. You know, more power to you. Do what you think is best." But until that happens, you know, I assume that there's going to be an election on November 8th. And so I filled out the paperwork with the Federal Election Commission, and I'm going through this process within the rules that are in place. So I think we can do a lot better by having somebody that's more neutral as a president. I don't think that should be a party-specific position. I think that we need to unite Americans. There's some candidates that you named there that I don't think are going to unite Americans if they get elected. I don't think
any of them will.
No, absolutely not. But like a Donald Trump, even within his own party, you know, has been extremely divisive. And, you know, to go a little bit further on what you just said, you know, if I go out to a sports bar and we've got the, you know, NCAAs and stuff, I'm from Oregon, and we got Oregon playing some basketball right now. But, you know, if I'm out and somebody finds out I'm running for president, I don't try to shove it down their throat in public like at a sports bar or something. But if they find out, they'll start asking me, what are your thoughts on this? What are your thoughts on that? And usually the first three or four things, they go, yeah, I agree with you on that. I agree with you on that. And eventually they get to one, they go, oh, you lost my vote. Because just what you said there, that they want you to be perfect. You know, they want you to do that exact match. I think that it's very important that people look at the big picture, you know, and nobody's going to agree on everything. Again, I'm always open to hearing other points of view. The other thing that separates me from other candidates is that there's some issues that I know you're very passionate about. Such as the reality of September 11th, 2001. And, you know, these other candidates are not going to address that. And we've had a Republican and a Democrat as president since then who've almost said the exact same words to not question the official story of 9/11. And here we are today, 15 years later.
Well, you know, I might end up voting for you just on that, because I can't bring myself to vote for somebody who's covering up 9/11. And so in 2008, I voted for Cynthia McKinney, who's a very brave voice of 9/11 truth. She grilled Rumsfeld on the floor of the House of Representatives about the war games that were used to run the false flag event. And she lived to tell the tale. And so I'm very proud of having voted for Cynthia in 2008, not Obama, who I knew was going to be a big disappointment. And then in 2012, I voted for Merlin Miller. Merlin Miller is poles apart from Cynthia McKinney in terms of the left-right paradigm, but actually the two of them would get along pretty well and actually could be part of the same ticket. He is a passionate 9/11 truther, and both Cynthia McKinney and Merlin Miller know darn well who really did 9/11. I talked about this during the first hour, but it's clearly the main thrust of 9/11 was about taking the entire West, especially the U.S., to war against Israel's enemies for the next century, if not the millennium. That's really what it was about, and also to prevent the political empowerment of Muslims within the Western democracies. It was actually organized Muslim voters who put Bush into the White House. Samuel Arian organized the American Muslim community. He flipped that community from 90% voting Democrat to, in the year 2000, 90% plus voted Republican, which is what allowed Bush to claim victory, falsely. But he was close enough, he could steal the election, and it's all because of the Muslim vote. And if that trend to empowering Muslims within the democracies in the U.S. and Europe where it had continued post-2000, Israel wouldn't even exist today. It would have been out of business by 2010. So that's what 9/11 really was Operation Save Israel. And it's been quite successful so far, but the backlash is really building. And so in any case, Merlin and Cynthia, I think, both basically understand that. But I would vote for you as a truther, even if you weren't going to, you know, 100% agree with me on my analysis of who did 9/11 and why. Simply saying that we need the truth would probably satisfy me.
Yeah, I whenever it comes up, you know, and I this is probably my most passionate issue. You know, this is the one where I will be happy to donate time and you know, make phone calls and go out. I work with the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth in Oregon. Richard Gage is actually going to be at Portland State University on April 2nd for an event. So I do whatever I can with the local 9/11 groups. But whenever I talk about 9/11, the two things I just point people to is the three towers that came down that day, especially World Trade Center 7, and also the lack of wreckage at the Pentagon that indicates that it wasn't a Boeing 757 that hit there. Beyond that, I don't like how, you know, so often people end up fighting one another about the exact, what happened and who did it and things like that. I think the main thing just is that we do need to have a real investigation. We need to keep talking about it. And we need to, hopefully the people that are responsible for the planning, execution, or cover-up get punished to the fullest, no matter who they are.
Well, we would certainly hope so. Did you catch this latest news about Larry Silverstein admitting in a speech like a year and a half or something ago that they had completely planned this new Building 7 back in April of 2000? And at that time, the old Building 7, the 47-story building that was the highest security high-rise in the United States, it was the home away from Langley of the CIA. It had all of the Enron files and all of the Securities and Exchange Commission's most sensitive files. So this was the most sensitive and securitized high-rise in the United States. And so in April of 2000, according to Larry Silverstein himself, he and his people sat down and had a design meeting to start designing the replacement for Building 7. And at that time, there would have been no way to take down the original Building 7. You can't just take down a 47-story building in the middle of New York, as Richard Gage said on my False Flag Weekly News show this morning. So this makes no sense. How are you going to take it down to put up a new one? And at that time, of course, the tallest building that had ever been taken down in a controlled demolition was 30 stories, nothing like 47 stories, much less 110 stories like the towers. So anyway, Larry has now confessed that they had designed this new Building 7 a year before 9/11. It was all ready to go. And Richard Gage came on False Flag Weekly News today and discussed how, even without this confession, the timeline of Building 7 makes no sense. How could they get that thing, start construction in May, or by some accounts, June of 2002, there was 3 months of chaos at least after 9/11? And then to actually plan a building and to, you know, clean up the old site, and especially to build it over a Con Ed substation, and to get all of the designing done, all of the blueprints, everything, that mobilize everybody and get the construction going by May and or June of 2002, it makes no sense. So clearly, there's a huge timeline problem with Building 7, and it looks like Larry was probably right. He and his people probably did design the new replacement Building 7 in April of 2000. But he confessed it. You know, you can't make this stuff up. What can you say? Yeah.
Nothing. In some ways, nothing should surprise you about any of this, but I mean, it just more and more, and you know, I don't know. I said to somebody that's involved in the 9/11, works for the Architects and Engineers and does some classes at Portland Community College and 9/11 Studies Group, and I was commenting how well done it was, and he argued with me about that it wasn't, because, you know, it's so many things are so obvious. But bottom line is, they pulled it off. You know, it happened, and here we are 15 years later, and you see the results that have happened. So, I don't know, 15 years later, I'm thankful for the people that are still so involved, you know, and I see so many of the 9/11 Truth profile picture things that are up, and I think that's a really positive thing, because I still run into a lot of people that say, why does it matter? Why are you so focused on this 15 years later? And obviously it's impacted everything since and continues to.
Well, sure. You know, all of these nightmare stories we get about new kinds of snooping and surveillance and, you know, the government really just, you know, brutally cracking down on people across a broad spectrum of different groups of people and classes and, you know, ethnic groups and activities. And the government has become vastly more unpleasant, to say the least, since 9/11. If we're not living in a total 1984-style Orwellian matrix, it's getting pretty close. And this really does go back to that, you know, fear-inducing mind control operation of 9/11. And, of course, they picked that day, the 9/11, September 11th, which is the digitized as 911, because that's the number you call for emergency. That's the emergency number. And who do you call for help? The government. So this was the institution of a state of emergency in which everybody was brainwashed to run to the government for protection from those evil enemies. It's really pretty. A lot of these things are so obvious when you stop and think about them. And, you know, you just have to wonder, why hasn't there been a revolution yet?
Yeah, and I don't think anything will bring Americans together more than the truth about 9/11. I think it's going to be one of the really positive things in the long run. I look at, like, things in Baltimore and Ferguson, you know, where you have the riots as a result of police, maybe racially motivated police brutality, whatever you want to call it. You know, I think we're going to have things like that on a national scale for a while, you know, when the truth comes out. But I think that will be a part of the healing process. And after that shock and all that, you know, is completed, but I think that we're going to start requiring that we overturn some of those freedom robbing things that have come as a result of 9/11. I think we'll demand a less secretive government going forward. I think we're going to demand that those accountable are punished. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to bring Americans together.
I agree completely. I think that the people who think that it's okay to do a big false flag like 9/11, and there are people like that. There's Patrick Clawson at the American, called the Middle East WINEP. That's a Washington Institute for Near East Policy. This guy, Patrick, it's a big Israeli-funded think tank that's designed to try to, you know, push U.S. policy towards what Israel wants. Anyway, Patrick Clawson has his famous speech that got, you know, taped and put on YouTube, where he says, you know, the way we have to start a war with Iran is the traditional way. You know, we don't just go and start the war ourselves. We have to wait until they attack us. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You know, if McKinley'd have to wait until, you know, he wanted his war with Spain, but he couldn't get it until they blew up the Maine. And, you know, we couldn't get into World War One until they blew up the Lusitania, and on and on like this. And, you know, Gulf of Tonkin, blah, blah, blah. So what we need is to, you know, have Iran attack us. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You know, it's like he admits it. This is he says this is the traditional way that our wars start. And so there are people who actually think it's okay to do this. They think this is the traditional American way to start a war, is to stage a big false flag or to, you know, manipulate the enemy into attacking us, as we did to Japan in World War II. We would unite 99.9% of the country, but there is that, you know, 0.1% that thinks like Patrick Clawson.
Well, at this point, I'd take those numbers, because I think we're so divided right now. You know, it's total gridlock that way. And it's neighbor versus neighbor, and that's by design as well. So.
That's a good point. Well, you know, Ed, there's a little bit of a hiccup in your connection. So we don't need the video, because this is just audio radio. So maybe you could you just turn off your camera, and maybe that'll speed up the bandwidth enough that we'll get rid of that hiccup. It's not bad sound quality. There's like, if you move. Yeah, there we go. Cool. So what led you to address this problem by running for president?
Well, you know, I'm 37 years old. It wasn't something where I ever had a thing where I was sitting around going, as soon as I turn 35, I'm going to run for president. It just happens that at the first election that I would be able to run, I have the desire to give this a shot. More than anything, really, it's just that I feel at the end of the day, the two people that come out of the primaries for the Republican-Democrat Party are very similar. You know, and I wanted to give people an alternative to that. There's just a number of things. I mean, I've been told that you can't win, that you have to be a billionaire to run, that elections are rigged, presidents are selected, not elected, and all these things. And I got a little bit sick of hearing it, and said, you know, I'm going to see firsthand, you know, what I'm up against, and you know, what's the reality here. Sorry, I got a little distracted looking down here at my Skype here, so lost my train of thought for a moment. But the point is that, you know, I just wanted to give people an option again, the 9/11 thing is a big deal to me, where again, you've had the Republican and Democrat as president that both told us not to question the official story. And to me, that's a reason right there to get away from those options.
Well, that makes sense to me. So how about the logistics of running for president? I'm not familiar with those. I did run for Congress in 2008, and I learned what those logistics involve, which is in Wisconsin, you have to gather at least 1,000 good signatures, which means you better get probably 1,400 signatures, period, because some of them are going to get disqualified. Yeah. And that puts you on the ballot. And you know, that's really the main logistical impediment with running for president. What would it take to actually be a candidate for president?
Yeah, it's tough. It's that times, you know, 51, because you've got, you know, 50 states in Washington, D.C. It's tough. In Wisconsin, it's actually, my notes here say 2,000 to 4,000 signatures for me to get on the ballot. It might be that I need 2,000 good signatures in Wisconsin, and that I can turn in up to 4,000.
That's what it means.
My home state of Oregon, it's 18,000 signatures. And wow. Again, like you say, I mean, that's probably 25,000 to make that happen. Some states, Utah, Idaho, Vermont, are that 1,000 number, where, again, you're going to need about 1,400. But then you look at a state like Texas, for example, and I want to emphasize this because we're running out of time to get on the Texas ballot, and it's really set up in a way that makes it almost impossible for a non-party or independent candidate like myself to get on their ballot. I need 80,000 verified signatures. So again, you're looking at about 115,000 to make that happen. And on top of that, anybody that voted, and again, these are registered voters, within that state that actually physically sign a petition, it's not an online petition or something like that, and then these people cannot have voted in Texas, cannot have voted in the primary. So it just makes it that much harder. On top of that, we only had a 60-day window to get those. And, you know, so in order for this to happen, you know, if any of the audience out there is from Texas and says, you know, that's just so difficult that let's just make it happen, you know, let's actually say, you know, to heck with their system and find a way to get this done, you know, but we need to get extremely organized and have a lot of volunteers in any state to get on their ballot. You know, I'm pretty close to Idaho and the state of Washington. And of course I live in Oregon, and Idaho and Washington are two of the easier states in theory to get on their ballot. So I'm going to, you know, concentrate on those a bit just to do my best to make sure I get on some ballots. But you know, a Texas would be nice because I've got a lot of support down there as far as, you know, like-minded people that, I think that we could actually get some votes down there if we appeared on their ballot. But again, it's such a challenge to get that many signatures. California, it's 180,000 signatures. Wow. We have a 105-day period to get it. And so, again, it's going to be about 240,000. Now, the population in that state is very large. You know, if we got organized enough to do that and had enough people out collecting signatures, you know, that's possible. But you know, companies charge $2-3 a signature, you know, to get them. And in my case, I need volunteers. So it's very uphill.
Yeah. So are you trying to get 9/11 truth people as the main volunteers who are going to be out collecting signatures for you? Or how do you organize that?
It's tough to get anybody I get so many people that say, if you're on the ballot, I'll vote for you and things like that. And it's like, well, I'm not going to get on your ballot if we don't, you know, get out there and put in the hours and, you know, volunteer. So 9/11 truth people, absolutely. You know, pretty much any group that is actually organized already and passionate about what they represent. And if we're like-minded, 3%ers, I've got some supporters from various 3% and Oath Keeper organizations. And, you know, also the UFO community. I'm not somebody who's been an experiencer of UFOs, but that's another area that I'm for disclosure of anything that is classified, so long as it doesn't put our military or national defense in direct danger by doing so. And there's a lot of people out there that would like some, you know, representation in that area where they feel like they're not getting that. So that's another thing. I went out to Portland, Maine last August for a conference, and they had me address the the audience there, and it was an absolutely incredible experience. It was a 14-day trip I took on Greyhound from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine and back, and cool. 4 days on the bus, 6 days in Maine, 4 days on the bus back, and I went through about 15 or 16 states and met a lot of people. But, you know, that's another group of people that's very passionate. So within the MUFON groups or, you know, anyone out there, but the truth is that we're not where we need to be with that at all. I really need, you know, any listeners out there that have ideas or maybe groups where they think that people would help or even themselves, you know, print out the petition and go to your group that you're going to or your church or anywhere else and just collect some signatures. Even if people aren't going to vote for me, if they agree that it would be good to have more options on the ballot, you know, I appreciate the signature just to give us a shot. And my belief is even these diehard, and now we're kind of running out of time on these, a lot more candidates are dropping out. But, you know, I've talked to so many people that said, you know, I'm 100% Bernie Sanders. But if he doesn't win, I'm sure not going to vote for Hillary Clinton, or I'm 100% Ted Cruz. And, you know, same type of thing. Insert anybody, Rand Paul, Donald Trump. So I think whoever wins these primaries, the majority of people, even within their party, are not going to be satisfied. And maybe a slight exception on the Democrat side because there's only two major, you know, people running, but coming out of that. But, you know, the Republicans have so many people and we're so divided that I think that it's pretty safe to say that only 35 or 40% are going to be enthusiastic about who's going to win that.
Yeah, interesting. So just being, if you got on the ballot, it's conceivable that the choices would be so bad that people, even if they hadn't heard that much about you, maybe they would just vote for you. like none of the above.
Yeah, and two things real quick. One is there's about 1,600, I think, if anybody goes to Google and puts in FEC Form 2 filers, that's the paperwork you have to submit to run for president. And I think there's about 1,600 people that have filled out the paperwork. You don't have to fill out paperwork until you raise $5,000 in contributions or spend $5,000 on your campaign. So even more may be running. Maybe a few hundred of those are registered as Republican or Democrat. But the rest are, you know, smaller party or independent or non-affiliated people. So I think you're far better off voting for anyone rather than not voting at all. And that's one of the things I'm really up against is that there's a lot of people that are so fed up. And they're really people that probably would support me if they got to know me over these other choices that are being pushed down their throat by the mainstream media. And, you know, they believe, a lot of them, that not voting is the answer, that you know, vote nobody is one of these things I keep hearing about. And I just encourage people to go out and, you know, if it's not me, you know, there's plenty of other people out there that, you know, get to know some of them. And I've talked to probably 15 or 20 of them that, you know, if I wasn't running, they'd be people that I would have, you know, considered, you know, as somebody, you know, to get to know more and so on. So the final point on this is I think it's a positive that there are so many people across the country running. I don't think very many of them are putting in the effort that I am, frankly. And there is a lot of effort to put in to get on ballots and just to, you know, do interviews and raise awareness that you are an option. But that being said, I think, for example, if I'm out here doing this show and someone hears me and then they go and on the ballot, I don't make it on there, but another one of these independents get on there, I think it's a positive because maybe the listener goes, you know what, I'm going to select that person. Or in my case, maybe I get on a ballot and nobody's ever heard of me, but maybe they'll select me for the same reason, because they did hear someone else that woke them up to the idea that there are a lot more options than what we're being told about.
I think the Trump phenomenon shows that there is this populist wave that people are not really trained to obey the mainstream quite as much anymore, that there's a lot of anger about the way that the elite has looted American jobs, sent them overseas, the way we've had this series of catastrophic wars since 9/11 that are really not for the U.S. national interest, that have bankrupted our country and spent trillions of dollars on who knows what, basically just destabilizing the Middle East. And I don't even think the Israelis are really going to benefit from this. I think it's going to crash down on their heads even harder. But in any case, it's really been a series of catastrophes. And I think the people are starting to realize that they've been had. And Trump is surfing that wave, and he's surfing it quite brilliantly. But at some point, I have to wonder if, you know, his posing is going to end up looking kind of empty. People are going to realize that maybe he's not quite the authentic voice of populist honesty and truth as he sounds. And at that point, they might be able to step, you know, one step further and start looking into genuinely independent candidates.
Yeah, you still, at the end of the day, you've got to, you know, and I've got no problem with anybody that's made money and done things the legit way. You know, I'm not against that by any means. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think people are fed up with career politicians, and they're fed up with billionaires that are, you know, always the options. And I've been told over and over again, you know, how much money do you have? You can't, you know, run unless you're a multimillionaire and this sort of thing. And my belief is this, you know, if we can raise enough money to be able to pay the fees, for example, in Louisiana and Colorado combined, those are the first two states that I would be able to get on their ballots once I come up with $1,500 total for ballot access fees. So if we get that money donated, that money to come in, and if you go to edbaker2016.com, there's information on there on how you can do that, how you can make a contribution. But if we can get on, you know, those ballots, you know, that's a huge step. But the bottom line is that I think the American people are going to appreciate candidates that are running on responsible and relatable budgets against candidates that are just spending hundreds of millions of dollars on their campaigns. You know, Donald Trump has claimed that he's already spent $20 million or something in that ballpark. And he makes a big deal about not taking, you know, corporate money, but he has on his page, you know, multiple donate buttons where he's certainly still collecting some money. And even the money that he's put into his campaign, the majority of it he's called a loan, which means that as more money comes in later, he can pay himself back for that. So, you know, and then you got even Bernie Sanders, I think, brought in $20 million in January or something like that. So, good for them. You know, we're up against tremendous odds. The main thing is I use social media. I do any interview that I have the opportunity. I'm so thankful to be able to be introduced to your audience. And then I use email and my phone and work out of here in Portland, Oregon, and try to reach people all over the country. So, you know, it's tough to raise awareness. It's tough to get on ballots. But if we can do that enough, I feel like some of this money these guys are just throwing around may end up being the nails in their coffin at the end of the day.
Well, we're seeing a shift in the media environment. So the mainstream media still is clinging to its role as the ultimate arbiter of truth, but more and more people are just not listening to what the mainstream says. And when they do see mainstream stories, they're not getting them from a, you know, supposedly neutral official source like their local newspaper or a big TV chain, but they get it from their social media feed. And a lot more stuff is coming through, you know, stuff about 9/11 truth or UFO disclosure or the various other kinds of issues and perspectives that are associated with those of us in the alternative information community, because, you know, we now have a way to reach people. So there are legions of info activists, like you said, people who are putting 9/11 truth as their profile image in social media. And that's where the information is getting filtered now. It's not all filtered through these mainstream media nodes anymore. Yeah, a lot of it kind of goes through there, but then it ends up getting refiltered and refiltered and refiltered through the social media. And that's where the info activists have a big say. And I think that the info activism is most effective around the issue of false flags. That's why I'm glad that you're forefronting 9/11 truth, because it's really the only issue where awareness per se actually affects reality. I mean, sure, the quantum physicists tell us that awareness is always affecting reality, but with most of these issues, like, you know, educating people about war and peace, well, then they have to go out and demonstrate, or they have to vote for a peacenik candidate or whatever. They have to do something else. They can't, if they just know that war is bad, peace is good, that, you know, America has been at war for most of its history and it's time to stop that, and all this sort of stuff. Just knowing that doesn't accomplish all that much, whereas with the false flag issues like 9/11 truth, the moment that people become aware of the pervasive false flags that are being used to shape our consciousness. That awareness neutralizes false flags as a tool of the malefactors, and it makes it impossible for them to do any more false flags, or at least much harder. It reverses the effect of previous false flags, like all the people that got brainwashed on 9/11 to fear Al-Qaeda, to give the government special powers, and to march off to war and kill people overseas in large numbers. Those people, once they wake up to the false flag of 9/11, they turn all the way around, and now they're fighting for personal freedom against Big Brother and the surveillance state and the NSA. They're pro-peace. They want to get the empire out of all those 900 military bases all over the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And most importantly, they are going to make sure that the next time the false flaggers blow something up and say that it was their enemy that did it, that no, that they're not going to believe it, and they're going to be spreading the news on social media and everywhere else they go that we shouldn't believe the story. So just the awareness of false flags has a huge effect that awareness on any other issue really doesn't have. And so it's tailor-made for the internet, tailor-made for social media. And that's why I think it's so important that people like you, Ed, are out there running for office and, you know, carrying the torch on the false flag issue, because this is the issue that's going to erupt out of the social media and change the world.
Yeah, I agree. And thank you for saying that. I remember, I don't exactly know what months that, you know, it was, or but when it was so obvious we were going to start bombing Syria, and it was like a foregone conclusion that this was going to happen. And I saw like some social media stats or whatever that were showing that around 90% of people were against the idea of going to war or something in Syria, or, you know, dropping bombs there. And here in Portland, Oregon, just, you know, living downtown, there were so many people out with signs and protesting that. And I just think that that's a sign that people aren't buying into as much what they're being told, you know, is how it is, you know. And I think that that's a really a big positive. And I think that, that the numbers are much more in favor of people that are questioning what they're being told and doing their own research. I love these radio shows, you know, like what you've got here. And I've been so fortunate to be on, you know, 50 or so now. And several of them I will do my best to keep up with. And the guests that you guys bring on, you know, if the audience will hear them, you know, those are the people we need to be listening to, you know. And I can't believe, frankly, that CNN and some of these other places are even able to still be in business after the things that have come out, where, you know, they made up stories that are just so it's just insane. You know, the things like the Iraq war thing on CNN, where they claimed that they were there and the guy's putting on his gas mask and, you know, all this stuff, and here he was, I guess, in Atlanta or something doing that. But so many things where there's a green screen or in other ways that they falsified the information. You know, I encourage people to just go on YouTube and just watch some of those videos. And to me, it's just, you know, get those in the face of some people that just swear by CNN and Fox News and these other things, because to me, it was really eye-opening, even being somebody that already is pretty well awake to things, just seeing just how blatant it is. It's ridiculous.
Well, you mentioned that false flag fail in Al-Ruta, Syria. I agree. I think that was monumental and historic. And that was really, in a sense, the moment that false flag consciousness kind of matured to the point that, you know, Obama had stupidly drawn a red line. He said, if Assad uses chemical weapons, we're going to bomb the hell out of them. That's my red line. And so naturally, the people who want that bombing campaign, which would be the war party here in the U.S., these Saudis, the Israelis, these hardliners who want the U.S. to bomb Syria, they all got together and said, hey, well, let's make sure that it looks like Assad used chemical weapons. So they themselves went up and used chemical weapons on Al-Ruta, and it was really obvious that, you know, they killed, most of the people they killed were actually Assad supporters. This happened right at the moment that the UN chemical weapons team was landing at the airport a few miles away. I mean, tailor-made to use as a big propaganda piece. So it was really obvious this was a false flag, and it didn't really fool anybody. And even Obama got mixed messages from the people around him. So he finally had to, against all of this pressure, he said, okay, forget it. We're not going to do this bombing thing. And of course, all of the policy wonks, the neocons and the insiders in Washington, D.C. were all horrified. What do you mean you're not going to bomb Syria? Well, he's not, because the false flag consciousness has spread to the point that he couldn't get away with it. And so that's a huge step forward. And, yeah, you know, a few more steps like that, and they're not going to be able to have another big war.
No, and I don't know. You know, you mentioned earlier on about the Iran thing, and you know, I just keep thinking about nuclear. You know, they keep pushing all this talk about nuclear weapons all the time, and I just wonder if there'll be something in the United States, you know, with a false flag nuclear type thing. You know, I don't know. I just say keep your eyes open and don't believe the first thing you're told. You know, when the media already has the narrative and already has body counts, you know, or doesn't even have a body count by the time the president is, you know, already talking about what the issue is and what we're going to do and all this sort of thing. You know, and you got these people that already have the whole story, you know, right away, these, you know, witnesses or, you know, interviews that they do on the street with the people that are obviously crisis actors, I guess they call it. And, you know, just keep your eyes open for those kind of things, because it's just happening over and over again. It's to a point where I won't even watch videos of like the Boston bombing or, you know, these other things, because I'm so sick of everything being a false flag or seeming to be, that I start, you know, I don't like being labeled conspiracy theorist. I look at each issue and I some things are just obvious, that the official story is not what we're told. So the things that I focus on is 9/11 mostly, and then also a little bit on the JFK thing, because that's very obvious. And also Sandy Hook, I will encourage people to not believe what we were told there. But beyond that, honestly, I try not to even get into those other things, because I just start feeling like I lose my voice on the issues I'm extremely passionate about, where there's so much information out there that we just need to keep pushing people towards, you know, and just let them decide for themselves. But that's what the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and the people here in Oregon, you know, that's what we do. We just get material out in people's hand and encourage them to keep researching it.
All right. Well, I'm with you on that, although I do keep up with false flags, because that's kind of become my bailiwick after I got forced out of the University of Wisconsin for studying 9/11 in ways I wasn't supposed to. So I have nothing better to do now than to push back against them by exposing all of these false flags, and most recently the two Paris false flags of 2015 and the San Bernardino false flag are the subjects of my latest two books. But I hear you. There's so many of these false flags now that it reaches the point where I would think a normal person would just kind of say, yeah, this next time they're, you know, running, it looks like a false flag. It quacks like a false flag, probably a false flag. I don't think I even need to study the details and watch the YouTubes anymore.
Yeah. Well, I just feel like I start losing, like, you know, the people that just aren't awake, you know, and you're trying to open their eyes a little bit. I just feel like once I start naming off 7 or 8 of them at once, then I just start sounding like I don't know.
I hear you.
But literally, that's how much my own, you know, how much I research things is just because it's so common. You know, I got to a point where I was going, you know, is every horribly evil thing that happens in America, is it, you know, or around the world even, you know, is it, is that level of evil only capable of people that are putting on these things? And I don't think that's quite true, but I mean, it sure is a lot of it. It is, you know, that's what it ends up being. So anyway, so thank you so much for what you do and all the people out there that are listening that are involved with helping raise awareness and you know, help open people's eyes. For me, the first thing that got my attention was when George Bush gave a speech and said, do not allow yourself to question the official story of 9/11 and, you know, these conspiracy theories, yada, yada. And when he said it, it just, something.
We must never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories.
Yes, yes. And when he said it, just something clicked with me where I said, that's weird. Or why would he tell me not to, you know, just something didn't seem right. And right away, the very first video I found, right away, I probably went on YouTube and found a Richard Gage video, as it turned out, an Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth 2-hour video, and watched it straight through. And man, I had no idea it was going to put me down this, you know, I don't know how many hours, 500 hours, 600 hours that I've spent watching anything I can find, reading anything I can find on it. You know, so somebody told me the other day they disagree with us about 9/11, you know, and they were on Facebook and making fun of my campaign and whatever. And I said I was going to be on a show or something and talk about 9/11, and she made a post that, no, I'm going to watch a rerun. You know, I don't want to, so on. And I normally don't get into back and forth. I'm very positive, and, you know, it's, you know, I don't give them any of my energy. But I did respond to that particular one and said, you know, I don't blame you. You know, once you wake up, you can't go back to sleep. You know, I don't blame you for watching a rerun. You know, it is. I mean, once you get into this, you get pretty invested. And I'm so thankful I did, because I don't know. I just feel a lot better about myself and about my awareness, and that I'm not going to keep falling for these type of things that we're being told.
All right. Well, I don't blame you for kind of, you know, staying back a little bit from, you know, every single false flag story that's out there, because, of course, what happens is you talk to people who aren't aware of this stuff. You know, my own sister actually, you know, scoffs at me saying, oh, you believe all the conspiracy theories. You know, I tell her about JFK and RFK and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Paul Wellstone and 9/11 and the Federal Reserve and on and on and on and on and on. I mean, you know, every U.S. war since the Mexican War has been launched with a false flag or orchestrated war trigger event, yada, yada, yada. And don't even get me started on UFO disclosure. And so, you know, her attitude is like, wow, you know, you're crazy. You know, you're not just one of these crazy people who believes one conspiracy theory. You're super crazy because you believe all the conspiracy theories. I say, no, I don't. There's a couple I don't. I like the Paul is dead thing. I'm not convinced of that yet. but yeah, it you know, it is hard to sort of bring people along, because the thing is, it's not that I believe all the conspiracy theories. What it is, of course, is that we're living in a matrix, and the information sphere around us has been fabricated by various groups for their own interests, and it's normal. So we've just been taught to believe a bunch of lies. It's not surprising that once you puncture one lie, and you find, oh, there's another lie that you can puncture too, and, you know, it's a whole gestalt problem here. But, you know, speaking of the gestalt problem, Ellen Brown in the first hour was, you know, she's well known for her work on the need to reform the currency system and to take the power to create money out of nothing at interest by lending it into existence at interest, to take that power out of the hands of the central banksters and to have governments issue transparent public currency. Is that something that you would support? Would you nominate her for Secretary of the Treasury?
Well, I was asked on an interview some time ago who would be the first person I would hire, you know, if I was elected. And my answer was I probably haven't even met them yet, you know, and probably never heard of them yet, you know. So that's very possible. You know, it sounds like somebody that you know, I need experts if I am elected, you know, to help in their areas of expertise. I'm trying to learn what I can. I know everybody that I've talked to that you know, such as I haven't talked to Ron Paul, but you know, I've looked at Ron Paul and Michael Howell of Fighting the Tyranny, and he's, you know, extremely big on ending the Federal Reserve, and you know, everything I learn about that seems to be obvious that we need to do that. I don't exactly understand, you know, how that works when you have so much debt with it, and that interest was never, you know, created money for that. So I don't exactly understand how you wipe out what there is there as far as the debt. You know, but I am trying to learn about things like Bitcoin, and, you know, again, anybody out there that has ideas on this, and it sounds like she has a lot of ideas on it, you know, I definitely want to talk to and learn from. And
yeah, I would think that Ellen would be a great person to advise any decent president. And, you know, others would include John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He's a very, very bright guy, and he has a new version of that book that just came out. And Douglas Rushkoff is another really interesting critic of the corporatocracy. He cut his teeth as an analyst of the media revolution and the, you know, internet revolution. And his latest couple of books, though, have really cut to the heart of the problem of the corporatocracy, which is the same problem really that John Perkins talks about. And it seems to me that, you know, Rushkoff is really barking up a lot of right trees when, you know, he says that the corporations were actually engineered not to create free market competition, but to destroy free market competition, because the whole history of corporations is that, you know, they're limited liability so that the investors are not even risking the rest of their money. The corporation can commit crimes. It can steal. It can have huge judgments against it. And nobody who's set the corporation on the path to doing this, that is the investors who put money into it and told it what to do, is liable. So the corporation was set up as a way of systematically evading responsibility on the part of the wealthy. And it also was set up to create monopolies and destroy free market competition. All of the original corporations were chartered by governments, and they were given monopolies on various fields. The British East India Company, the Dutch East India Company, et cetera, were models. That's what corporations are. Their whole purpose is to get bigger and bigger and bigger, to grow cancerously, and then to destroy competition and to extract as much value as possible out of their environments and then sit on it unproductively. That's what the structure of corporations actually does. And so I think, you know, Rushkoff is really looking at something important here. I would go so far as to argue that we should abolish limited liability corporations, and we should also abolish this fractional reserve lending, which is just counterfeiting. You know, it's like if I have, you know, 10 pounds of gold and I put out notes, you know, redeemable for gold in the that add up to a total of hundreds of pounds of gold. And if every, you know, obviously I'm counterfeiting. And that's what the banksters are doing to create the currency. So that's cheating. It's counterfeiting. It's robbery. And that's what creates our money system. And likewise, corporations are systematic instruments for preventing the people behind them, the people who put the money into them, from taking individual responsibility for their actions. So I would argue abolish all forms of fractional reserve lending, because that's counterfeiting. Arrest all those people, arrest the Rothschilds as counterfeiters. And we need to break up all corporations and eliminate the institution of the limited liability corporation. Go back to a world in which individuals are the economic agents and they take responsibility for their own actions. So, anyway, that's my platform.
Awesome. I appreciate you sharing that with me. And as you said there right at the very end of that about the individuals, you know, that's something that I really push people from the political idea as well. You know, people try to fit into this box of I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm a, you know, this, I'm a that. And as I've been going out to some events here in Portland and the area, you know, I'll go to a Republican event or an independent event or, you know, anywhere that I can go and meet people and give out, you know, get signatures for my petition and so on for Oregon. And I've talked to so many people that have told me the only reason I joined this party, these are people that have ran for office and so on. You know, I ran as an independent and I only got 5% of the vote or I couldn't win. So I joined, you know, this and these type of things where it just more and more proves my belief and makes me more confident than ever that I'm doing the right thing by running as a, you know, non-affiliated, because I am. I'm an individual. And I think people need to really try to get away from the labels and trying to fit into these boxes so I just encourage people to keep doing that.
All right. Well, you mentioned earlier the UFO disclosure issue, and that's actually one that a lot of listeners here at Revolution Radio are interested in. And it's also one, of course, that the mainstream has done everything to try to prevent people from looking into objectively by surrounding it with mockery and ridicule. And yet, if you look at Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project videos and you see these dozens of retired military guys all begging to be dragged before Congress and forced to testify under oath about their experiences with saucers and ETs and, you know, live aliens and all this kind of stuff. I mean, you'd have to be crazy not to say, yeah, take those guys to Congress and let them testify under oath and let's investigate this and find out what the heck's going on. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, there's a man named Eric Mitchell from Portland, Maine, and I met him on Facebook and he started talking to me about disclosure. I didn't even know what he was talking about exactly, and he was saying, you know, that there's millions of people in America that are not being represented. And after some back and forth, I came to realize he was talking about UFOs. And what we immediately agreed on is that we need less government secrecy. And again, I'm not an experiencer, you know, but I started looking at some videos. And one of them that I came across was, I forget now if it was called the National Press Club or National, something of that regard. And it had, I think, eight or so retired military people that had worked at nuclear test sites, and they were giving some form of testimony about their experiences. And they were representing, I think, 100 or 150 military people that had signed off on this as well, that they've each had an experience. You know, and so that was another thing for me, is because I'm very big believer in our that our military is, to me, is our top priority, our men and women, the people that are our active military veterans and their families. And I want to make sure that each of those groups have representation at all times. But I was like, you know, these people want to share their stories about what they witnessed and the things that happened at these nuclear test sites. To me, that, you know, that's a whole other angle on this whole thing, that we've got to listen to our military and we've got to include them.
Hear, hear. Well, when you mentioned the National Press Club video, that probably was one of Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project videos. And those are, to me, very, very convincing. I mean, even if those people are all disinformation agents telling stories that somebody scripted for them, or if they're all crazy or who knows what, let them testify under oath and look into it. And if they're lying, then prosecute them, you know. But this is potentially very important, and it's stupid to just rule out the possibility that we could be experiencing contact with ETs. I mean, why not? The universe is huge, and, you know, why do we think that we're the only intelligent, technologically advanced life form in the universe? I mean, that's pretty, it's a lot of hubris to think that way.
Yeah. I'm probably not an expert on much of any individual issue. You know, there was a point where I had 80 videos on my laptop about all different topics that people were asking me about. But I went out to that conference in Portland, Maine, and I met so many people and I listened to so many things. And your listeners, many of them are probably familiar with Travis Walton, Fire in the Sky. Mm-hmm. They're from Arizona, and he was there. And, you know, when you have five or six people passing lie detector tests about the same issue, that's a pretty good sign that something really happened.
So something's worth investigating there for sure. Yeah. All right. Well, hey, we hit the end of the hour. Thank you so much, Ed Baker. Your website is edbaker2016.
Edbaker2016.com. You can find me on Facebook as well with that.
All right, Ed Baker, 2016. Well, keep up the great work. I am quite likely to end up voting for you. You sound like my kind of candidate. So, hey, keep
Thanks
up the great
much.
Work. Have a good one. Ed Baker of Ed Baker 2016. I'm Kevin Barrett of TruthJihad.com. Back next week for live Truth Jihad Radio.
Thank you for listening. Thank you.